This recording comes from the Medical Recording Service and Sound Library of the College of General Practitioners of the United Kingdom. Why People Fall Ill. The speaker is Dr. George Day of Munsley Hospital, Norfolk. Dr. Day.
When I was a medical student, good health seemed to be the normal state. You are born in good health, and you remain, so to speak, static in that condition until something went wrong with the works, and then you were ill. Given time, of course, your works would wear out in any case, and then you died. There was a lot of knowledge as to how the works went wrong. Our teachers showed us how to locate the faulty part. This was called diagnosis. Our textbooks devoted several chapters or sections to each organ and detailed all the different things that could go wrong with it. For treatment, diseases fell into two categories. You either went to a physician and he would give you something, or you went to a surgeon and he would take something away. There was an intermediate, rather unsatisfactory sort of patient, and he was shipped off to the electrical department, where they had high voltage Wimshurst machines and statics and all sorts of capers. This mechanismic somatic medicine did not tell us why people got ill, nor how they could be prevented from getting ill. Every layman is acquainted with well-authenticated stories of presumably healthy primitive men turning their faces to the wall and dying for no ascertainable organic cause, but just because a spell had been put on them. Every general practitioner is struck at some time or another by the way Darby will follow Joan to the churchyard before the leaves have turned. People behave as no machine has ever behaved. And so one grew dissatisfied with this mechanismic approach and shifted insensibly towards the biological approach. The organism's environment was now taken far more into account, and the concept was widened to include both the machine and the road it was travelling. At once, an entirely new light was thrown upon the business of keeping well. Good health became equated with adjustment to environment. Failure to adjust spelled disease. The maintenance of good health ceased to be a dull, static condition, but an exciting, dynamic process, as highly skilled and as dangerous as tightrope walking. One was struck with admiration by the way in which one dealt with all the dangers that beset one every moment of one's life. More and more blame was thrown on the environment for being so beastly, especially by the bacteriologists who were, and still are, discovering more and more noxious microorganisms to account for more and more illnesses. But the question remained unanswered. Why did one person remain well while another one got ill? Granted that, as far as one could see, they both enjoyed the same shocking, awful environment. Then immunology and allergy were discovered. Some people had more than others. The acid test was that those who escaped illness must have the higher immunity, and vice versa. Just like the differential test between mushrooms and toadstools. And people who avoided an illness in January but succumbed to it in February showed seasonal fluctuations in their immunity. And this became linked up with vitamin deficiency, which is always a safe bet, and hormone balance, which is coming along nicely, and other good, rich scientific dodges. Even so, this did not seem to get down to the root of the problem. And then came psychosomatic medicine. Let me try to convey what I mean by the psychosomatic approach to medicine. You'll have to forgive me for quoting myself. It is easier to give a concept of the term psychosomatic than actually to pin it down by a definition. My own tentative conception is that it is analogous to the term electromagnetic. As you will remember well from your first MB days, in an electromagnetic system, it is impossible to alter the flow of electricity without altering the magnetic field. Conversely, any variation in the magnetic field is at once reflected in the electrical potential. The two are as inseparable as the heads and tails on a coin, being merely different observable aspects of the same phenomenon. In the same way, every alteration in the psyche affects the soma, and vice versa, because, and this is the important and difficult thing to grasp, they are different but interdependent aspects of the same thing, a living individual. Perhaps we'd better clear the ground a bit more. I won't attempt to define soma, the body, except to remind you that it is alive, and so must not be confused with the things you once dissected, and that it manages to keep alive by diligently performing all sorts of complicated chemical processes which are outside our knowledge and control. Indeed, it seems so determined to keep alive, so cunning at overcoming obstacles against its survival, so clever at repairing itself when damaged, and so ruthless when reproducing its kind, that it may very well have a mind of its own, of which we are quite oblivious. The psyche, I would diffidently remind you, embraces more than the conscious mental processes. Those processes concerned with remembering and forgetting, the evaluation of facts, and the arrival at decisions. It includes also the emotions, those dynamic forces which move you to action or move you to anger, laughter, or tears. Sometimes these emotions pop up quite uninvited into the fields of consciousness, but more often they remain the backroom boys, or rather the boiler house boys of the psyche. Often, too, they seem to derive their force and direction from that somatic will to live. Well, I went on to say, the phrase psychosomatic medicine suggests investigating the patient as a whole, accepting the idea that in every condition of life, both psyche and soma are affected, and in practice, treating whichever is handier. There's nothing new in this, I went on, but with the advent of every new specific drug, serum, vaccine, and operation, the emphasis is shifting more and more towards soma and further from psyche. General medicine, and surgery in particular, is concerning itself increasingly with ridding a patient of the physical handicap of his illness and getting him back to work. Sometimes this is rather like performing highly skilled running repairs on the car, when really it may be the driver who needs attention. Such treatment does not make the patient whole. It's no cure. Psychosomatic medicine, studying the patient as a whole, would seek to make it unnecessary for him to break down again. The concept, you see, has widened still further, and our analogy now includes the machine, the road, and the driver. And, of course, the driver must take his share of the responsibility when things go wrong. Moreover, his personality and habits are likely to predetermine the sort of things that are going to go wrong. For instance, the chap who drives on his brakes is going to wear out both his brake linings and his tires. Different horrors await the fools who never change down, who fail to replenish with oil and water, who drive with a load on their minds or a load on their knees, or who attenuate their contact with the reality situation with analgesic liquor. And of course it is true that, drive as carefully and as soberly as he will, no man can escape the fortuitous puncture and its possible dire consequences. Similarly, the psychosomatic approach suggests that every man in his humour, be it choler, melancholy, phlegm, or blood, is subject to the appropriate disease. For a humour doth so possess a man that it doth draw all his affects, his spirits, and his powers in their confluxions all to run one way. Or in modern parlance, certain personality types are associated with psychosomatic affections. Thus there is the asthmatic personality type, the hyperpyetic type, the mucus colitis type, the menstrual disorder type, and the arthritic type. An element of predestiny is beginning to creep in. Free choice of ailments is becoming a mockery. And is it entirely true to say that, live as carefully and as soberly as he will, No man can escape the fortuitous accident and its possible dire consequences. Are accidents fortuitous, befalling the just and the unjust, like rain? No. Certain individuals appear to be more accident-prone than occasion or statistical probabilities would warrant. As a class, these individuals are not clumsier or more careless than their fellows. It seems as if every now and then they were assailed by a need to go and hurt themselves. At this point, it's timely to turn to Grodick and his philosophy. For Grodick was the father, or perhaps the grandfather, at any rate the jolly uncle of the modern psychosomatic approach. At the beginning of this century, George Grodick, himself a doctor's son, was a physician practicing at Baden, who only undertook chronic cases of whom his colleagues had despaired as hopeless. These he treated with bed rest, lots of water inside and out, and strenuous, personally conducted massage. During the massage sessions, his patients relaxed and talked about themselves, and Grodick listened. It was only after he had cured many incurables and won considerable fame that he discovered that the massage part really wasn't necessary, except as a means to get the patient talking freely. He listened to his patients, and from what they told him in words and from their response to his ministrations, he evolved a psychology very similar to that of Freud's, except that Grodick's concept embraced all illnesses, organic as well as psychoneuroses. Grodick's teaching was, life is lived by the it. The it was to him an entirely unconscious part of the psyche, bursting with energy and possessing a sort of mind of its own, an entirely irrational, amoral and primitive mind which was apt to direct this energy to suit its own requirements regardless of consequences. Just like Harpo Marx. The reactions of Harpo are it-directed without any appreciable inhibition or control, apart from the Hayes office. He will, for instance, chase every pretty blonde he sees and, if possible, tear off all her clothes. This, by Grodick's reckoning, is exactly the sort of thing our it, at any rate the male's it, would like to do. But our ego or superego is strong enough, usually, to repress the impulse. Thus conscience doth make cowards of us all, and enterprises of great pith and moment, with this regard their currents turn awry, and lose the name of action. Instead of action, we may enjoy the idea as a brief daydream, or we may be so strongly inhibited that even this satisfaction is denied us, because the impulse is never allowed to reach our consciousness, even as an idea. There's always a confused sort of logic shaping Harpo's activities, the logic of punning, leading via displacement towards symbolism. When warned that a document lacks a seal, he triumphantly deposits a live sea lion upon it. Asked for a secret agent's record, he slaps down a gramophone disc. He dresses in the stage costume of an operatic tenor and is perplexed and dismayed to find that he is still dumb. Because when the tenor dons these same clothes, he sings and sings as if nothing could stop him. Grodick's it shows the same paranomasia. The stomach is the one organ which can reject what it doesn't like. So vomiting is seized by the it as a symbol of rejection and is called into play when anything offends the it, an obnoxious smell, the sight of blood, irritating substances in or around the brain, even fertilized ova establishing themselves in the uterine mucosa. Fainting, that mock death, is enacted when consciousness of the reality situation becomes intolerable. On an equally superficial level, this histrionic symbolism shows itself again and again in conversion hysteria. The young soldier who has accidentally shot his mate will regain consciousness with a paralyzed right hand. His right hand has offended him, and he has symbolically cut it off. Spasmodic torticollis is developed by the unhappy Peeping Tom, who wants to look but dare not. Not all the IT's objectives are amoral, antisocial, or destructive. Sometimes our ego is in complete harmony with our IT, and then we are 100% happy and efficient. Thus do we enjoy our simpler pleasures, resting when tired, eating when hungry, drinking when thirsty, and even when not, taking violent exercise when restless. Yes, and writing love letters or the Brandenburg concertos, painting the Last Judgment or the Town Red, planning 40,000-ton liners or booby traps for our sisters. For on these occasions, we are successfully humbugging the IT with counterfeit currency, performing acts of creation, symbolizing the primal creative act, which is the IT's deepest craving. At other times, when the IT is tugging at the leash in the opposite direction, we are neither completely happy nor efficient. It is then that accidents happen to us. We hurt ourselves or develop trivial ailments. If we fail utterly to come to terms with our IT, it is apt to take charge and play merry hell with us, and it is then we get really ill. Grodick warns us, the IT always gets what it wants, every time, either actually or in symbolic form. Illnesses and accidents are thus to be regarded, according to Grodick, as purposefully fulfilling the needs and desires of the IT. They may thus be a means for the IT to avoid unpleasant duties, to achieve irresponsibility, laziness, and the regression to a childlike state of dependence upon others. We can buy love, attention, and importance by being ill. We learnt that in our cots. They curb our activities. They break the monotony of life. And they punish us. Patients are seldom free from deep guilt feelings, although they've quite forgotten what they feel guilty about. Why else should they ask, why should this happen to me? What have I done to deserve this? Sometimes it is asked with jocular plaintiveness, but more often it is put very seriously indeed, and they proceed to extol their somewhat negatively virtuous lives, exactly like the Pharisee at prayer. Occasionally this recital sounds a little tinged with regret, as much as to say, had I known this was coming to me in any case, I might not have been such a good boy. They've got what they didn't bargain for. In all organic diseases, in all accidents, Grodick sought the same sort of symbolism as is so manifest in hysteria, was always seeking to understand the organ jargon of the body, and thus to discover what the IT was trying to convey by its charades. Such was Grodick's concept. Such was the basis of his therapy, and he was a great healer, no doubt about it, not of psychoneuroses and conversion hysterias, but of patients suffering from good, honest-to-God, conjoint-type organic disabilities. He asked, why did this patient take ill when he did? What sort of an individual was he before he took ill? How had life been treating him in the past? How had he been treating life? What has been leading up to his illness? What has precipitated it? And why did he take ill how he did? What purpose does this illness serve? Of what is it symbolic? What is the IT trying to tell him? Instead of prescribing something like a physician or subtracting something like a surgeon, he held, as 'twere, a mirror up to his patient's nature and made them see what had been previously concealed from them. His concept, moreover, did furnish a reason, albeit a fantastic reason, why people got ill, and taught a rule of life for the avoidance of illness, namely, come to terms with your IT. But we cannot go all the way with Grodick. Sometimes we can glimpse the IT at work in other people when their asthma, their peptic ulcer, or their migraine plays up at what seems to all onlookers to be exactly the appropriate moment, although, of course, never to the victim himself. But we cannot stomach the idea that we ourselves are mere puppets, activated by anything so irresponsible, so bafflingly impish and mischievous as the Harpo IT. As to listening to one's IT, why, surely the next step would be frank schizophrenia. The British concept of psychosomatic medicine, in comparison with Grotek's, is as stolid and respectable as the Forsyte saga. And I am at a loss to know why it meets with such angry or derisive resistance. Of the many ills that flesh is heir to, Halliday has listed a mere handful, some 30-odd, as being psychosomatic affections. These, he has shown, possess certain etiological features in common, chiefly that these diseases are chronic and given to remissions and recrudescences, and that their onset, remissions, and recrudescences are often determined by emotional experiences, that a particular personality type tends to be associated with each particular disorder, and, his greatest contribution, that the incidence rate of these diseases in a community is affected by changes in that community's psychosocial setting. In practice, what it all boils down to is the investigation of the patient's personality type and his history of precipitating emotional trauma. And most workers find that this is quite time-consuming enough. Let us not mistake concepts for the truth. With our limited perceptions, we can never apprehend the truth about anything. Sitting as we are with our backs to the light, each of us has to interpret the shadow play on the wall and the echoes of the cosmos according to his own experience. Each of us has to select from the cosmic Rorschach blot those details which seem significant and which allow themselves to be organized into an intelligible system. The simple concept of a half crown as an embossed disc of silvery metal is easy to grasp and handle. When it turns into a dust storm of atoms with vast interstellar spaces, or a dance of protons, neutrons, and electrons, or a phenomenon of ineffable wave motion, it becomes unwieldy. We cannot grasp it in the same way. We don't want to grasp it in the same way, because it has somehow ceased to be half a crown, although it may be nearer the truth. Of necessity, we must be prepared to deal with concepts of varying complexity and as mutually contradictory as those of energized particles and wave motion appear to be. Naturally enough, we select the simplest that satisfies our immediate needs. In medicine, the mechanismic approach suffices when feeding the mixer Demeters with thyroid or when whipping out the angry appendix. The biological approach is desirable when dealing with an epidemic of paratyrophoid fever, and the psychosomatic approach justifies its vast time expenditure in those chronic diseases whose course is so often influenced by emotional factors. When we examine pulmonary tuberculosis in the light of psychosomatic medicine, what do we find? Halliday does not recognize it as a psychosomatic affection, and it certainly does not fulfill his sevenfold criteria. Some of them, yes. Emotional traumata within the 18 to 24 months preceding the onset of the disease is found in a very large number of cases, quite large enough to be statistically significant. The disease, too, is phasic. It can play cat and mouse with its victim. The course of the illness is very definitely affected by changes in the inner emotional environment. But what about the particularity of the personality type? About 12 years ago, no more than that now, I was determined to find out. By means of the Rorschach projection test administered to 400 consecutive patients admitted to my sanatorium, I tried to ascertain what peculiar personality traits, if any, these tuberculous patients might show in common. At the same time, Witkauer was trying to do very much the same thing with other groups of patients along entirely different lines. I'm sure he will forgive me if I state quite boldly that we both failed to arrive at any conclusion. Tuberculosis did not appear to be the prerogative or predilection of any specific personality type as revealed by psychological testing. More recently, I have set to work from the opposite direction. There were, I reflected among my friends and acquaintances, those who could not conceivably develop tuberculosis, or if they did, could not possibly die of the disease or allow it to become chronic. They would make a good recovery, and the whole business would have been an episode, a few months stepping aside from the hurly-burly in their normal span of life. I compared notes with physicians at other sanatoria and found them in agreement with me. So we made lists of these immunes, and it became an intensely interesting study, especially when we widened the field to include well-known characters in fact or fiction. But let me go to the other extreme and give you an account of one Tomkinson, a real patient with a borrowed name. Tomkinson was a farm labourer, but his heart was not in his job. He was left a little money and bought a dreary little haberdasher shop with it and got married. The shop failed and Tomkinson developed pulmonary tuberculosis. His more successful brother came to his aid, and so he came under our care. He was not, physically speaking, a very advanced case. He was not ill-nourished. His wife had looked after him very well. He was not burning with resentment or frustration, for he seemed to accept his lifelong failure quite unemotionally, almost apathetically, as the sort of thing that should be expected to happen to him. With PAS and streptomycin, those therapeutic big brothers fighting his battle for him, his downhill course was delayed, but it was evident from the day of his admission that he could never recover. This death sentence could not be substantiated by his X-ray appearances, sedimentation rate, temperature swings, or any other accessible data. Not even on his history, if narrated second-hand, could the final outcome be so definitely foretold. For we all know of those who could pick themselves out from the deepest slough and fight their way out of the toughest spot. No, just one look at the man, a bare 5 minutes in his company, were as conclusive as a blown-out fuse. For my part, I found him an awkward customer. I failed utterly to develop any sort of rapport with him. Not to put too fine a point on it, he hated my guts. Now, it was clear that he didn't know me one-tenth well enough to do this with any conviction, so I assumed, quite rightly I subsequently learned from his wife, that he was identifying me with his elder brother, whose bounty had got him under treatment earlier than otherwise would have been possible. Poor Tomkinson had never learned to accept. He hated being under any obligation, and he hated his benefactors. He also had a sad, forgiving smile, which I found intensely irritating. In short, we were not cut out for one another. Post, and I hasten to add, not propter hoc, his condition deteriorated patently. He packed up, went home, and died a few months later. What can it be, I ask, that my TB immunes have in common, of which some others haven't got enough of, and in which friend Tomkinson was so sadly lacking? Vitality? Courage? Plenty of tuberculous patients have them in abundance. Indomitability? Steadfastness of purpose? We're getting warmer. I suggest it is pneuma, the neglected third party in the Greek triad. Pneuma, the spirit of life, which is indomitable, which through faith urges towards a goal not impossible of attainment, and so is triumphant. My immunes, like Prince Hal, were as full of spirit as a May morning. It used to be said by my late senior partner, Dr. Vere Pearson, among others, that tuberculosis was caused by frustration. But that cock won't fight. Tuberculosis is on the decline. Frustration, I'm told, on all hands is increasing. Frustration can no more cause the disease than can the ubiquitous tubercle bacillus. They can only cause the disease when on one plane the spirit is not strong enough to rise above the frustration, and on another when the body's resistance is not great enough to overcome the invader. This spirit of life must surely inspire every cell in the body, like an allergy. As Dr. Alfred Torrey, paraphrasing St. Paul, put it, the body is the temple of the spirit. The mind is its channel. In Greek ideology, pneuma, the spirit, is something separate and distinct from psyche, the mind. And this would excuse us for not discovering it in our psychological tests. So now we arrive at the concept of an indivisible triad, body, mind, and spirit, pneuma, psyche, and soma. An approach to medicine which I humbly suggest might be revived after centuries of desuetude. Elsewhere, I've likened body and mind to two horses in double harness, sometimes in opposition, sometimes in harmony, interdependent in that if one be lamed, the other must suffer disability. Now we have installed a driver of the chariot, pneuma, the spirit which urges the whole unit forward, guiding it to the light. If the pneuma fail at his job, all will soon head for the disaster, or come to a standstill. It is odd how we have neglected the spirit all these years. Presumably, when medicine was divorced from the church, the apothecary surgeon seized upon the treatment of the body and the mind, while the parson was left with the cure of souls. And he was never called in to see the case until his rivals had failed. And by always being put into bat last on a very poor wicket, his powers have naturally dwindled. Then, too, that ridiculous controversy of science versus religion didn't help. Like any sincere argument by the tone-deaf that music did not exist, it was invalidated from the start. But at the back of my mind, I still have Tomkinson on my conscience. Even all this highfalutin rigmarole be true, how is it going to help him? Should he be tossed to the parsons to see what they can do for him? Well, in the first place, he may not like parsons any more than some people like doctors. Then all parsons are not alike in their outlook. Some seem to be abandoning the spiritual discipline for the more exciting playing fields of psychoanalysis. If they can combine the two without losing their bearings, I'm quite sure they'd be very great healers. I once tried to collaborate with a young padre over a case. I said, "This man looks to me like a very unhappy man who has lost his faith in everything." The young padre said, "He looks to me like a manic depressive." We were both trying to pass the buck. Tomkinson was lacking in spirit. Can spirit be imparted where it is lacking, fortified where it is weak? Of course it can. In battle, a wavering line of troops. In the darkest days of the war, a whole nation can be rallied and inspired by the voice of a great leader. Once 12 dispirited villagers slunk into a room and were transformed into the stuff martyrs are made of. The body is the temple of the spirit. The mind is its channel. The basic trouble with Tomkinson was that he was an isolate, and I feel that the only hope might lie in his being initiated into a group. Wouldn't matter much what the group was, be it a bench of bishops, Masonic, or even the Brick Lane branch of the United Grand Junction Ebenezer Temperance Association, so long as it was a group of appropriate size where his absence or failure to participate made a difference to everyone else in the group. In fact, to the group as a whole. A group where he mattered to other people. When I was in general practice, I was involved each winter in producing Gilbert and Sullivan operas in one village, and in training a madrigal society in another village. But the participants in these different groups never got ill, during the season of activity at any rate. Absenteeism from rehearsals was exceptional, even in the 1929 and 1932 epidemics of flu, when I was visiting more than half the cottages in the neighborhood. We never postponed a show, we never played an understudy. In fact, we never bothered to rehearse understudies. At that time, I claimed that singing was prophylactic, but I am now drawn to the conclusion that any group of people happily engaged in some purposeful creative activity maintains a high average of health. As any service MO can confirm, the morale of a unit can be measured by the smallness of its sick parades. Out east, it was the browned-off troops who suffered from desert sores, not the crack-lit regiments in the line who are making history. Have we now, at long last, a hint as to how to prevent people from getting ill? You'll be asking, does this fellow advocate yet another branch of medicine? Pneumopsychosomatic medicine, with textbooks and glossy covered monthly journals of its own, subscription $20 a year, a further chair with a professor on its seat, a further 3 months course for the medical student with a question in the conjoint finals? No, 1,000 times no. I'm not advocating anything. I'm merely suggesting that sometimes, when we have the time, it might pay us to look on an all-too-familiar patient with a new approach. No, not a new approach, a very, very old approach. And ask ourselves, what is his or her spiritual strength? And whence is it derived? Is he a churchgoer? Has he friends, real friends? Is he an integral part of any community? What is he living for? It might also be worthwhile to consult with the parson about difficult, disappointing cases. Perhaps he can approach the patient individually on a religious basis, where we would feel a bit shamefaced and out of our depth. Perhaps he has some group activity in which the patient might be fitted, for Mr. and Mrs. Parson between them have their Bible study classes, their discussion groups, their sewing parties, mothers' unions, their boys' clubs, girls' clubs, their guilds, such little gatherings most days of the week. And they are thus already performing yeoman service in keeping people well and happy. If all these activities suddenly ceased, and there was nothing to take their place, our surgery waiting rooms would assuredly become even more crowded. Good night.
We should like to thank Smith, Klein and French Laboratories Limited for their generosity in paying for the cost of this recording. This recording was edited and produced by the Medical Recording Service of the College of General Practitioners of the United Kingdom.